This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Caesar's Way, the natural common sense guide to understanding and correcting all common dog problems. By Caesar Milan, with Melissa Jo Peltier. Read by John H. Mayer. Forward by Jada Pinkett Smith. Let me prepare you for the idea that you will learn just as much about yourself through Caesar Milan's dog psychology as you will about your dogs. You see, we humans are the ones who have lost the concept of the natural order in which our dogs function. Our lack of knowledge about the nature of our pets and their needs strips our animals of the natural instincts they use to survive. This creates an imbalanced, unhappy pet that is more of a headache than a joy. Caesar helps us understand the natural ways our dogs live so they become more balanced and happier. Our dogs, in this state, enable us to develop a healthier companionship with them. Through his patience and wisdom, Caesar has been a blessing to my family, my dogs, and me. So, new students, be open to learning new things, and be blessed. Forward by Martin Dealey, President, International Association of Canine Professionals. Today, even though we have more books, more help, more training gadgets, and definitely more treats, there are more badly behaved dogs than ever before. We have the means to help us achieve well-behaved dogs, yet we lack sufficient understanding of our dogs' natures. While most of us are well-intentioned and loving dog owners, this lack of understanding can create many common dog problems. Put simply, dogs are not small humans. They do not think like humans, act like humans, or see the world in the same way as humans. Dogs are dogs, and we need to respect them as dogs. We do them a huge disservice by treating them like humans, and thus create many of the bad behaviors we see today. From the first moment I saw Caesar Milan work with dogs on his show Dog Whisperer, I knew he understood this concept. He is a unique man who is not afraid to be politically incorrect, who talks about leadership with dogs, and is not afraid to give and show a correction when a dog requires it. I am continually impressed with the way Caesar interacts with both dogs and their owners. Caesar explains what is creating the problem in a way that every dog owner can understand. His personality, warmth, and humor are irresistible. In the presence of his charm, even the most stubborn owners listen and want a change. Not only can he explain the situation, he can also fix the problem. With a minimal amount of verbal communication, the dog complies, changing its attitude and its behavior. Dogs respond to Caesar's calm, confident approach. This is truly a man who knows how to speak dog. In this book, Caesar reminds us that the most important part of training a dog is building a healthy relationship between human and dog, one in which the boundaries between the two are clearly drawn. I know this to be critical from personal experience. My first dog, Kim, never showed aggression and never behaved improperly in public or when company visited my home. Today people would say, "What a well-trained dog." But it wasn't training. It was because we shared a relationship based on the three key elements Caesar details in this book: exercise, discipline, and affection. Caesar shows us how to build this kind of relationship and helps us understand our dogs in a better way. He also explains how dogs can change their behaviors and attitudes with the right approach. This is essential information for everyone who wants to live more peacefully with our valued companions. Introduction. Does your dog drive you crazy? Is he or she aggressive, nervous, fearful, or just plain high-strung? Perhaps your four-legged friend is obsessive about something, whether it's jumping on anyone who walks through the door or bugging you to play fetch with the same filthy green tennis ball over and over and over. Or maybe, just maybe, you believe you have the perfect pet but would like a more fulfilling relationship with him or her. You'd really like to learn what makes your dog tick. You want to get inside your dog's mind to foster a closer bond. If you answered yes to any of the above, then you've come to the right place. If you don't know me from my television series, Dog Whisperer, airing on the National Geographic Channel, let me introduce myself. My name is Cesar Millan, and I'm eager to share with you wisdom from my lifetime experience living and working with dogs, including the thousands of lost causes I've rehabilitated over the years. A little bit about me. I came to the United States from Mexico in 1990 with no money in my pocket and the dream and ambition to become the best dog trainer in the world. I started as a groomer, but in less than 10 years, I was working with packs of overly aggressive Rottweilers, including some dogs that happened to belong to a wonderful couple you may have heard about, Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith. Will and Jada, both responsible dog owners, were impressed by my natural talent with dogs, and they very generously recommended me to their friends and colleagues, many of them celebrities. I did no advertising. My business was strictly word of mouth. Soon I had a thriving business and was able to open my dog psychology center in South Los Angeles. There, I keep a pack of 30 to 40 dogs nobody else will take. Most of these animals I rescue from shelters or rescue organizations because they are considered unadoptable or have been abandoned by their owners for behavioral reasons. Sadly, since there aren't enough no-kill shelters to go around, most abandoned animals face certain euthanasia. But my rescued dogs, once rehabilitated, become happy, productive pack members. Many of them eventually find loving, responsible, adoptive families. And during their time in my pack, these dogs that were once destined for death row regularly play host to and serve as role models for my clients' problem dogs. There's a unique neediness in American dogs. I've seen it in their eyes and felt it in their energies from the first day I crossed over the border into the United States. America's pet dogs long to have what most dogs in the wild have naturally, the ability simply to be dogs, to live in a stable, balanced pack. American dogs struggle with an issue unknown to most of the world's dogs, the need to unlearn their owners' lovingly motivated but ultimately destructive efforts to transform them into four-legged people with fur. As a kid in Mexico, I watched Lassie and Rin Tin Tin and dreamed of becoming the world's greatest dog trainer. I don't call what I do training anymore. There are plenty of great trainers out there, people who can teach your dog to respond to such commands as sit, stay, come, and heal. That's not what I do. I do heavy-duty rehab. I deal with dog psychology, trying to connect with the dog's mind and natural instincts to help correct unwanted behavior. I don't use words or commands. I use energy and touch. When I come to a client's house, the owner usually thinks the problem lies with the dog. I always have in the back of my mind that the issue is most likely with the owner. I often tell my clients, I rehabilitate dogs, but I train people. The key to my method is what I call the power of the pack. Having grown up on a farm, around dogs that were work dogs, but not house pets, I had years of experience interacting with and observing dogs in their natural pack societies. The concept of a pack is ingrained in your dog's DNA. In a pack, there are only two roles, the role of leader and the role of follower. If you don't become your dog's pack leader, he will assume that role and try to dominate you. In America, most pet owners spoil their dogs and give them constant affection, thinking that this is enough for the dog. Simply stated, it's not enough. In a dog's world, getting only affection upsets his natural balance. By teaching my clients how to speak their dog's language, the language of the pack, I open up a whole new world for them. My goal in working with clients is to ensure that both the human and the dog end up healthier and happier. There are more than 65 million pet dogs in America. Over the past 10 years, the pet industry has doubled in size, with an income of about $34 billion. Yes, billion. American dog owners pamper their pets with such things as $5,700 green crocodile leather travel bags for miniature Yorkshire terriers and $30,000 insurance policies. On the average, dog owners can spend as much as $11,000 or more on their pet in that pet's lifetime, and that's one of the more conservative figures. This country definitely has the most spoiled dogs in the world. But are they the happiest? My answer, sadly, is no. What I hope you'll come away with after reading this book are some practical techniques for helping your dog with his problems. More important, however, I want you to gain a deeper understanding of how your dog sees the world and what he really wants and needs in order to live a peaceful, happy, balanced life. I believe almost all dogs are born in perfect balance, in tune with themselves and with nature. It is only when they live with humans that they develop the behavior problems that I call issues. And speaking of issues, who among us doesn't have a few? After applying my techniques, you may even begin to understand yourself better. You'll look at your own behavior in a different light and may find yourself changing the ways you interact with your children, your spouse, or your boss. After all, humans are pack animals too. I've heard from more viewers than you might imagine that my techniques have helped as many humans as they have dogs. Take an excerpt from this delightful fan letter, for example. Dear Caesar, thank you so much for your show, Dog Whisperer. The funny thing is, you've changed me and my family's life, and we don't even own a dog. I am a 41-year-old mother of two, a 5-year-old son, and a 6-year-old daughter. I was having a terrible time disciplining them. I learned they had no boundaries and limitations. My kids were pushing me around, literally, in public places and at home. And then I saw your show. Since then, I have trained myself to become a more assertive parent, using a more authority energy, demanding my space as an authority figure. I have also trained myself not to ask and beg them to do things, but to tell them to do things, such as clean up their room, clean up their eating area, and put away their laundered clothes. My life has changed, and so have they. To my amazement, my children have become more disciplined, and there's less fighting, and I found they actually like responsibilities and chores. They are proud when they accomplish a given task, and I am just thrilled. You have not only taught humans about their dogs, you have taught humans about themselves. Thank you so much, the Capino family. I owe a lot to dogs. Obviously, I owe my livelihood to them, but my gratitude goes much deeper. I owe my balance to dogs. I owe my experience of unconditional love to dogs and, as a boy, my ability to overcome loneliness. I owe my understanding of family to dogs, and they have helped me learn to be a better, more balanced pack leader with my wife for our kids. Dogs give us so much, but what do we really give them in return? a place to sleep, food, affection. But is that enough for them? They are so pure and unselfish in sharing their lives with us. Can't we take a deeper look inside their minds and hearts to discover what they really want? Some dog owners, I've come to believe, don't really want to do what it takes to fulfill their dog's lives because they fear it will upset the balance in the way their dog fulfills them. But in an ideal relationship, shouldn't both parties be getting their needs met? What I hope to do in this book is try to help all my readers give back to their dogs just a fraction of the many gifts their dogs give them. A note about gender. I grew up in Mexico, in a culture that you might call macho. Others in America might call it sexist. Whatever name you give it, it is a culture that does not value women the way they are valued in the United States. Women are respected as mothers, but their personal worth is not given anywhere near the significance it should be given. Women are not encouraged to have high self-esteem or to feel their importance in society. Since I came to America and married an American woman, I have been rehabilitated to the point where I believe no culture can be truly healthy unless it places on women the value they deserve. When it comes to the written word in my first book, the issue of how gender is handled is very important to me. Therefore, my co-writer and I have dealt with the issue of gender in the following way. In every other chapter, we will alternate between the masculine and feminine pronouns and adjectives when describing humans. In every other chapter, we will do the same when describing dogs. Therefore, in one chapter, he will describe a dog, and she will describe a human. Then we'll switch off, and so on. I credit my brilliant and beautiful wife, Illusion Wilson Milan, for opening my eyes to the vital role that women play in our human existence. They truly are the glue who hold our human packs together. Prologue. A Dog's Life. It's 6:45 in the morning, and the sun is just beginning to peek over the crest of the Santa Monica Mountains. We're heading due east, and the trail is quiet and empty. I haven't seen any sign of a human being yet, which is a good thing. When I'm running in the hills, followed by about 35 off-leash dogs, I always keep to the least traveled paths. The dogs aren't a danger, but they can look pretty formidable to someone who's never seen a man running with a pack of dogs behind him. We've been running for about a half hour now, and Giovanni, my assistant, follows the last dog, keeping up the rear of the pack and watching for stragglers. There rarely are any. Once we get into a rhythm, the pack and I churn up the dirt on this trail as if we were a unit, as if we were one animal. I lead, and they follow. I can hear their heavy breaths and the light scratches their feet make on the trail. They are calm and happy, and they trot lightly with their heads down and tails wagging. The dogs follow me in the order of their status, but since this pack is much larger than a wolf pack would be in the wild, the dogs divide themselves up into groups based on high, medium, and low energy. The smaller dogs have to run harder to keep up the pace. All the dogs are in migrating mode, and their instincts are in charge. So, I sometimes think, are mine. I breathe in deep. The air is clean and clear, and I can't smell even a trace of Los Angeles smog. It's a total rush, an exhilarating feeling. I feel at one with the outdoors, the dawn, and the dogs. I think of how blessed I am, that this is how I get to spend my days, that I have been allowed to enjoy this day as part of my life's work, my life's mission. On an average workday, I leave my home in Inglewood, California, and arrive at the Dog Psychology Center in South Los Angeles by 6 a.m., Giovanni and I will let the dogs out into the dirt-floored backyard of the center so they can relieve themselves after their night's rest. After that, We load them into a van and arrive in the mountains by no later than 6:30 a.m. We stay there for about 4 hours, alternating vigorous exercise with moderate exercise and rest. The exercise is as I've described. I lead the pack like an alpha wolf, and the dogs follow me. They are a motley crew, a ragtag mix of injured, rejected, thrown-away, rescued dogs, and my client's dogs, who've come to the center to return to their roots, in the dog sense, that is. We've got more than our fair share of pit bulls, Rottweilers, German Shepherds, and other powerful breeds, along with the Springer Spaniels, Italian Greyhounds, Bulldogs, and Chihuahuas. While I'm running, most of the dogs will be off-leash. If a dog needs to be leashed, an assistant will handle that. If there is any doubt about the dog's ability to be an obedient pack member, he stays home, and I exercise him in other ways. As diverse as they are, the dogs work together as a pack. Their deepest, most primal instinct guides them to follow me, their pack leader, to obey me, and to cooperate with one another. And each time we go through this exercise, I am more closely bonded with them. This is how nature intended a dog pack to work. What's remarkable is, whenever we're walking or running, the dogs of all breeds are indistinguishable. They are simply a pack. When we rest, they break up into breeds. The Rottweilers will all go together. They will dig a burrow in the ground to rest in. The pit bulls will lie down together, always in the middle of the pack, out in the sun, and the German Shepherds will go and lie under a shady tree. They all have their own style. Then, when it's time to run again, they'll all fall in as if there were no differences between them at all. The dog and animal in them is far stronger than the breed, at least when it comes to the serious business of migrating. Every day that I live with the dogs, they teach me something new about them. For everything that I do to help them, they give me 1,000 gifts in return. 10:45 a.m. We're back in South Los Angeles. After 4 hours of intensive exercise in the mountains, the dogs are ready for more water and for home. They come back to the center and rest under the shade of a two-story portico, a leafy tree, or in Thailand, what I call the row of 5 small private doghouses for the tinier ones among them. Some of the more active ones like to cool off in one of our pools before they crash. During the hour that they rest, from about 11 a.m. to noon, that's when I'll have consultations and an intake of new dogs at the center. The best time to introduce a new, unbalanced dog to a stable pack is when the pack is all pooped out. Now that they're exercised and rested, the dogs have earned their food, just like they'd have to do in nature. I like to prepare the food myself, scooping and mixing it with my bare hands so their food will always have their pack leader's scent in it. The feeding ritual at the Dog Psychology Center takes 1.5 to 2 hours, and it's designed to be a psychological challenge to the dogs. In human terms, an exercise in willpower. The dogs line up in front of me and wait. Only the mellowest, calmest, and most relaxed dog will get to eat first. This makes all the other dogs realize that the calmer and mellower they are, the more likely they will be to get what they want. The dogs have to eat next to one another without fighting or becoming dominant over the food. This is an enormous mental challenge for a dog, but one that helps ensure that the pack runs smoothly. Once the dogs have eaten and relieved themselves, they're ready for some more physical exercise. As you can see, I'm a great believer in both structure and intensive physical activity to help dogs achieve the kind of balance they would have if they lived naturally in a world without human influence. Our next activity is the most rigorous of the day, rollerblading. Believe it or not, most dogs love running with me while I rollerblade. They love the challenge of keeping up with a pack leader on wheels. I can rollerblade with a maximum of only 10 dogs at a time, so that's 3 or 4 sessions in a row. By mid-afternoon, everybody's had a shot at it. The dogs are exhausted, and so am I. While they rest for a couple of hours, I do phone consultations and office work. At about 5, we go out back and throw the ball for 20 minutes. At the Dog Psychology Center, between 30 and 40 dogs can play fetch with the same ball without a fight breaking out. That's what I call the power of the pack to influence good behavior. As the sun begins to dip, the pack goes into a resting mode for the remainder of the day. This is the best time for any one-on-one work I need to do with some of the various dogs. For instance, take Beauty, a lanky female German Shepherd who has a severe case of fear aggression. If anyone approaches her, she will shrink back and either run away or attack. In order to attach a leash to her collar, I have to chase after her, tire her out, and then wait until she submits. I may have to repeat this process 1,000 times until she realizes that when I put my hand out, the best solution is for her to come to me. Because Beauty has been exercising and participating in the pack all day, she is in the best state of mind for me to work with her on her issues. Today, more than 10 years after the Dog Psychology Center opened its doors, I maintain a small staff, comprising, in addition to myself, my wife Illusion and 4 other loyal employees. We care for an average of 30 to 40 dogs at a time. Many of the dogs in the pack at the center have been with us since the beginning. Some we consider our family pets, and they come home with us every night. We've become attached to so many of them that we have to alternate between whom we bring home. Other dogs are return visitors, belonging to longtime clients who like the balancing effect the pack has on their dogs. These clients bring their dogs to us whenever they travel. For their dogs, who are already psychologically healthy, coming to hang with the pack is like going to camp and reuniting with old friends. The rest of the dogs at the center are temporary visitors, dogs I bring here to help with their rehabilitation. The ratio for pack regulars to pack temporaries is about 50-50. Some of those pack temporaries are dogs rescued from shelters, dogs that might be euthanized if they can't be turned into social animals fast. The others are dogs who belong to private clients. I like to tell people that the dogs from clients are the ones that keep the business going, and those from rescue organizations are the ones that keep my karma going. Most of my private clients don't need to send their dogs to the center to get them well, just as not all human beings need to go to group therapy to deal with their psychological issues. Most of the cases I handle involve dogs who simply need stronger leadership from their owners, plus rules, boundaries, limitations, and consistency in their own homes to become better. But there are other cases where the best solution is to bring the dogs to have the support and influence of their own kind so they can relearn how to be dogs. Because so many of our dogs are from rescue organizations, many of them have heartbreaking stories, some involving the incredible cruelty some humans inflict on animals. Rosemary had one of those stories. A pit bull mix, she had been bred to fight other dogs in illegal pit fights. After she lost an important fight, her owners poured gasoline over her and lit her on fire. A rescue organization saved her life, and she recovered from her burns, but it was clear that her horrific experience had turned her into a dangerously human-aggressive dog. She started biting people. I heard about Rosemary after she attacked two elderly men, and immediately offered to take her and try to rehabilitate her. Rosemary was presented to me as a deadly, dangerous dog. When I brought her to the center, however, turning her around proved to be a piece of cake. All she needed was a safe place and solid leadership in order to regain her trust in people. Before, she had felt intimidated by people, so she'd make the first move. That's when she'd attack, because in her experience, if she didn't attack a person, that person would hurt her. It took no more than 2 days for me to earn her trust. After that, she was the sweetest, most obedient dog you could imagine. She wasn't born to be a killer. Humans had made her that way. Once she was living in the center, surrounded by the energy of stable, balanced dogs, she proved to be a very smooth case. Rosemary now lives with an adoptive family who loves her and can't believe she was ever human aggressive. She turned out to be one of the best ambassadors for the Dog Psychology Center that I could ever imagine. Like Rosemary, Popeye was found wandering the streets by a rescue organization and ended up here because the rescue workers couldn't handle him. Popeye is a purebred pit bull who lost his eye in an illegal fight. Now that he was damaged goods, his owners had no more use for him and abandoned him. While he was adjusting to having only one eye, Popeye became very suspicious of other dogs because his vision of the world had narrowed and he felt vulnerable. He responded by approaching other dogs very aggressively in order to intimidate them, which would almost always start a fight. Then he started attacking people. When he came to me, he was very pushy, dominant, and high-strung. He was a much more difficult case because his energy was so strong, so I always had to be extra alert and aware around him. Today, he's a mellow, trusted member of the pack, and no one here gives him a hard time because he has only one eye. We have a lot of pit bulls in the pack, not because they are more dangerous than other dogs, but because they are among the most powerful breeds and are often the hardest for rescue organizations to handle when the dogs develop issues, particularly aggression. Unfortunately for pit bulls, many people raise them for illegal fighting or for protection, so they are conditioned to bring out the aggressive side of their nature. Preston is also a pit bull, and he's enormous. He lived with an 80-year-old man, spending his whole life closed up with the man inside an apartment. Because Preston's got a naturally calm disposition, he never became destructive while his owner was alive. Preston was there when his owner passed away, and he was found by the man's landlord, who called the Amanda Foundation. When they came and got him, he was very shy. Shy dogs are often candidates for fearful aggression. When they put Preston into a kennel and then tried to take him out again, he started lashing out at everybody. Because he's such a big guy, his rescuers grew to be afraid of him. When I brought him here, however, I could see right away that he was actually a scared, insecure guy. He was one of the rare dogs that I threw right into the pack full-time, from day one. Being a naturally calm fellow, Preston picked up on the relaxed, stable energy of the other pack members and almost instantly reverted to being just like them. He calmed down immediately, and although he still looks scary to most visitors, I know his secret. He's really a gentle giant. Even though I keep no favorites at the center, Scarlet, a petite black-and-white French bulldog, is one dog to whom I have become very attached. She comes home with me often, and my sons consider her a family pet. Scarlet was the newest dog in a house full of dogs and other pets. Her owners had a rabbit that got out of its hutch, and Scarlet attacked it and took its eye out. I came to the owner's house and worked with Scarlett. She wasn't even a case I felt needed to go to the center. The problem wasn't Scarlett. It was her owners. There was no discipline in the house. No rules, boundaries, or limitations. And the owners were rarely home to supervise all the various animals they had running loose on the property. I gave the owners a lot of homework, but they didn't change anything. A few weeks later, Scarlett took the leg off a chihuahua that was living with them. Because Scarlett was the most aggressive dog and the newest one in their pack, the owners once again blamed her. I didn't think there was any hope for her in that household, so I offered to adopt her myself. Now she's so sweet and calm, she can go anywhere with me. I think of her as my good luck charm. Whenever I need an extra stroke of luck, I rub her tummy like a Buddha. She's never failed me yet. Oliver and Dakota are two brown and white Springer Spaniels. Both have physical issues resulting from too much inbreeding, such as recurring infections in the eyes and ears. Dakota is the worse off. I believe that each dog comes into your life to teach you something. Dakota was the dog who taught me about neurological damage, a problem I can't fix. Dakota's energy is off. Everything about him, from his bark to the way he chases shadows, is very unbalanced. Because there is no aggression allowed in the pack, ever, the other dogs don't hurt him, and he can live peacefully. In nature, he would be targeted and attacked for his weakness, and would probably not survive. I wish I could introduce you to all of the dogs in the pack, because they all have equally fascinating stories and histories. However, they all share one thing. For them, being part of their own kind has a profound meaning. Being part of a family of people wouldn't have that same kind of meaning. They would be comfortable, and maybe even spoiled, but their lives would lack this primal meaning. So when these dogs get to be part of their own kind, regardless of the breed, they feel complete. I wish that all of the dogs in America, in the world, could be as balanced and fulfilled as the dogs in my pack. My goal in life is to help rehabilitate as many of the problem dogs as I possibly can. As the evening wears on, it's time for me to go home to my human pack, my wife Illusion, and our two sons, Andre and Calvin. Giovanni will remain for the night, tending to the dog's needs and putting them in their kennels when it's time to sleep. After about 7 to 8 hours of exercise, they are ready to crash. Tomorrow, the cycle will repeat again, with either me or one of my colleagues at the center. This is my life, a dog's life, and I couldn't be more blessed to be living it. Through this book, I invite you to experience it with me. Chapter 1. Growing Up with Dogs, A View from the Other Side of the Border. We woke up before the sun, those summer mornings on the farm. There wasn't any electricity, so once the sky turned dim in the evenings, there was little for us kids to do in the candlelight. While the adults talked softly into the night, my older sister and I would try to drift off to sleep in the stifling heat. We needed no alarm clocks. Our wake-up call was that first sliver of backlit golden dust streaming through the unscreened open window. The first sounds to reach my ears would be the chickens, their insistent clucking in competition for the grain my grandfather was already spreading around the yard. If I lazed in bed long enough, I'd smell the coffee brewing on the stove and hear the swishing of the water in the ceramic buckets my grandmother carried up from the well. Before she came into the house, she would softly sprinkle some of the water onto the dirt road in front of the doorstep, so the cows wouldn't suffocate us with the dust they churned up as they passed by on their morning parade to the river. Most days, however, the last thing I wanted to do was stay in bed. I couldn't wait to get up and go outside. The only place I really wanted to be was among the animals. From as early as I can remember, I loved to spend hours walking with them or just silently watching them, trying to figure out how their wild minds worked. Whether it was a cat, a chicken, a bull, or a goat, I wanted to know what the world looked like through the eyes of each animal, and I wanted to understand that animal from the inside out. I never thought of them as the same as us, but I can't remember ever thinking animals were less than us either. I was always endlessly fascinated and delighted by our differences. My mother still tells me that from the time I could reach out and touch any animal, I could never learn enough about it. And always, the animals that attracted me most were dogs. In our family, having dogs around was like having water to drink. Canines were a constant presence in my childhood, and I can't overstate their importance to my development in becoming the man I am today. I wouldn't want to imagine a world that didn't have dogs in it. I respect dogs' dignity as proud and miraculous animals. I marvel at their loyalty, consistency, resiliency, and strength. I continue to grow spiritually from studying their seamless link with Mother Nature, despite thousands of years of living side by side with man. To say that I love dogs doesn't even come close to describing my deep feelings and affinity for them. I was very blessed to have had a wonderful childhood spent living in proximity to dogs and many other animals, since I also grew up in Mexico, in a very different culture from the one you have here in the United States. I had the advantage of seeing your country and customs from a newcomer's perspective. Though I'm not a veterinarian, a PhD, or a biologist, I have successfully rehabilitated thousands of problem dogs over the years, and it's both my observation and my opinion that many dogs in America are not as happy or as stable as they could be. I'd like to offer you a more balanced, healthier way to love your dog, a way that promises you the kind of deep connection you always dreamed of having with a non-human animal. I hope, after sharing with you my experiences and my personal story of a life shaped by dogs, you may begin to have a different perspective on the relationship we humans share with our canine friends. The Farm. I was born and spent most of my earliest years in Culiacán, one of the oldest cities in Mexico, located about 643 miles from Mexico City. My most vivid childhood memories, however, are of spending every vacation and weekend at my grandfather's farm in Ixpalino, about an hour away. In the Sinaloa region of Mexico, farms like the one my grandfather lived on operated on a kind of feudal system. The farm or ranch was owned by the patrones, the richer families in Mexico. My grandfather was one of many workers and ranch families known as campesinos who rented ejidos, parcels of land, and earned their meager incomes working them. Those farm families made up a community. The land they worked was what they had in common. You could compare this to the sharecropper situation in the American South. The primary job my grandfather had was to care for the cows, dozens of them, and see them safely from the pasture to the stream and back again, every day. We also raised chickens and other animals, mostly for our own food. The house was cramped, built long and narrow and mostly of brick and clay. It had only four rooms, which got kind of crowded once my other sisters and brother were born, and whenever our many cousins came to visit. I was already 14 or 15 years old when we first got running water, yet I never recall feeling poor. In that part of Mexico, The working class was the majority, and in my young eyes, that farm was paradise. I would rather have been there than at Magic Mountain any day. The farm was always the place where I felt I could really be me, the person I was born to be. It was the place that made me feel truly connected to nature. And always there in the background were the dogs, usually living in loosely formed packs of 5 to 7 animals. They weren't wild, but they weren't indoor dogs either. They lived outside in the yard and came and went as they pleased. Most were a concoction of mixed breeds, many of them resembling something between a small German shepherd, a Labrador, and a Basenji. The dogs always felt like part of our family, but they weren't anything like pets in the modern American sense of the word. These farm dogs all worked for a living. They helped keep the other animals in line, running alongside or behind my grandfather as he herded the cows, working to keep the cows from straying from the path. The dogs also performed other functions, such as protecting our land and property. If any of the workmen left a hat behind in the field, you could be sure one of the dogs would stay behind to watch it until the owner returned. They also took care of the women in the family. If my grandmother walked to the fields at lunchtime, carrying meals for the workers, a dog or two would always go with her, lest an aggressive pig appeared to try to take the food away from her. The dogs always protected us. We took this for granted, and we never taught them to do any of these things, not in the sense of dog training as most people know it. We didn't shout commands to them as trainers do, or reward them with cookies. We never physically abused them to get them to obey us. They simply did the jobs that needed doing. Something about how they helped us seemed to be in their nature already, or perhaps they had passed the behaviors down from generation to generation. In exchange for their assistance, we'd throw them a burrito or two now and then. Otherwise, they scavenged for their food or hunted smaller animals. They happily interacted with us, but they also had their own distinctive lifestyle, their own culture, if you will. These working dogs on our farm were my true teachers in the art and science of canine psychology. I always loved to watch dogs. I suppose your average American kid will run and play fetch with his canine companion, throw a frisbee to her, play tug of war, or wrestle with her in the grass. From the time I was very little, I found joy in dogs simply by observing them. When the dogs weren't hanging around us or interacting with the other animals on the farm, I'd watch them play with one another. Very early, I learned to read their body language, such as the play bow position, when one dog would invite another for a frolic. I remember them grabbing one another's ears and rolling on the ground. Sometimes they'd run and explore together. Sometimes they'd team up and excavate a gopher hole. When their work day was done, some of them would rush to jump in the creek to cool off. The less bold among them would lie quietly on the bank and watch the others. Their daily patterns and rhythms formed a culture unto itself. The mothers disciplined their pups, so the pups learned the rules of the pack at a very young age. Their packs and family units definitely operated like an organized society, with clear rules and boundaries. The more hours I spent watching them, the more questions came into my mind. How did they coordinate their activities? How did they communicate with one another? I noticed early on that a simple glance from one dog to another could change the dynamic of the whole pack in a split second. What was going on between them? What were they saying to one another, and how were they saying it? I soon learned that I could have an effect on them, too. If I wanted something from them, for example, if I wanted one of them to follow me into the field, it seemed I only had to put that thought in my mind, think of what direction I wanted to go in, and the dog could read my mind and obey. How did she know how to do that? I was also fascinated by the endless number of things dogs were able to learn about the complex world around them simply by trial and error. Was part of what they knew about nature already inborn, I wondered? The vast knowledge they displayed about their environment and how to survive in it seemed to spring from an equal combination of nature and nurture. For example, I have a vivid memory of watching a couple of adolescent pups approaching a scorpion, probably for the first time in their young lives. They obviously were fascinated by this outlandish creature, and they inched toward it, tentatively, leading with their noses. As soon as they got close, the scorpion started to move toward them, and the puppies jumped back. Then, the puppies began sniffing around the scorpion all over again, then backed off, then started again, but never got so close as to be stung by it. How did they know how far they could go? Was the scorpion sending them signals as to what its boundaries were? How did those two pups sense the scorpion's poison? I witnessed the same thing with one of our other dogs and a rattlesnake. Did she smell danger from the rattlesnake? I knew the way I had been taught that an animal was poisonous. My father told me, "You go near that scorpion, and I'm going to spank you." Or, "If you touch that snake, you'll get poisoned." But you never saw a dog father or a dog mother telling a pup, "This is how it is." These pups learned from experience and watching other dogs, but they also seemed to have a kind of sixth sense about nature, a sense that even as a boy, I observed to be missing from most of the humans I knew. These dogs seemed completely in tune with Mother Nature, and that's what amazed me and drew me back to observe them day after day. Pack leaders and pack followers. There was something else I noticed quite young. A set of behaviors that seemed to separate the dogs on my grandfather's farm from the dogs on some of the other families' farms. Some of the other ranchers seemed to have dogs with fairly tight pack structures, where one dog was pack leader and the others were followers. Those families liked to watch when their dogs got into battles over dominance, when one dog beat another down. This was entertainment for them. I could see that such dominance displays were natural behavior for dogs. I had also witnessed it in the feral dog packs that ran wild in the fields near our house, but that kind of behavior wasn't acceptable for my grandfather. The dogs on our farm didn't seem to have a discernible pack leader among them. I realize now that this was because my grandfather never let any dog take the leadership role away from him, or from the rest of us humans, for that matter. He instinctively understood that for the dogs to live in harmony with us, to work willingly with us on the farm, and never show aggression or dominance toward us, they all had to understand that we humans were their pack leaders. You could see it in their postures around us. Their body language communicated clear, classic, calm submission, or active submission. Qualities of energy that I'll describe in greater detail later. The dogs' heads were always low, and they always kept a certain position in relation to us when traveling, trotting either behind or next to us, and never running out in front. Now, my grandfather never had any training manuals or self-help books or scientific techniques to rely on, yet he could always elicit that perfectly calm, submissive, and cooperative response from his dogs. I never witnessed my grandfather use any violent punishment, and he didn't bribe the dogs with treats. What he did was project the kind of consistent, calm, assertive energy that just cries out leader in any language, for any species. My grandfather was one of the most confident, even-tempered people I've ever met, and definitely the person most in tune with nature. I think he recognized that of all his grandkids, I was the one born with that same special gift. The wisest thing he ever said to me was, "Never work against Mother Nature. You only succeed when you work with her." To this very day, I repeat that to myself and to my clients whenever I work with dogs. And sometimes, when I'm feeling stressed, I apply it to other areas of my life. Though my grandfather passed away at the age of 105, I quietly thank him every day for that timeless piece of wisdom. Living among dogs that had that gentle, compliant state of mind, none of us kids ever developed a fear that one of the dogs would harm us. We were always confident around them, and therefore, we too naturally became their leaders. I never once saw a dog bare her teeth to growl at or act aggressively toward my grandfather, and not one of the children in the family was ever hurt or bitten by a dog. My experience, learning from my wise grandfather on the farm, has convinced me that when dogs and humans live together, a calm, submissive state of mind is the best state of mind for the dog to have. My family and I grew up among dogs with that state of mind, and our relationship with those dogs was one of pure, relaxed harmony. And the dogs, too, always seemed happy, relaxed, serene, and content. They didn't exhibit stress or anxious behavior. They were healthy, balanced dogs, as nature intended them to be. I don't want to give all the credit for my amazing and unique childhood to my grandparents. My father was the most honest, honorable man I've ever met. He taught me about integrity. My mother, however, taught me about patience and sacrifice. She always talked about the importance of having a dream, and to dream as big as you like. But, like some people who grow up to work with animals, I always felt a little different from the other kids. I seemed to connect better with animals than with people. That feeling of isolation increased when we started spending less time on the farm and more time in the busy seaside city of Mazatlan. The move was motivated by my dad's concern about our education. He was a traditional Mexican son, very devoted to his parents, yet he realized that there were no real schools at the ranch. Sometimes teachers would come and hold classes for a few of the farm kids, but often they wouldn't come back again for a long time. My dad wanted us kids to take our education more seriously. So we moved to Mazatlan, Mexico's second largest coastal city and a vacation mecca. I was probably about 6 or 7 years old. Life in the city. Dog eat dog. I remember our first apartment in Mazatlan. Trust me, it never would have made the cover of Metropolitan Home. It was on the second floor of an apartment building on Calle Morelos in the crowded working-class part of town. It was very long and narrow, like a railroad flat in Manhattan, a living room, kitchen, hallway, and 2 bedrooms, one for our parents, the other for all us kids. There was a bathroom where you'd also wash your clothes. That was it. My father got a job delivering newspapers, and we kids dressed in one another's hand-me-downs and went to school every day. For me, the worst thing about living in the city was that we couldn't have dogs around anymore. When we first brought dogs to the apartment, we let them live in the hallway, but they smelled bad, and we weren't very disciplined about cleaning up after them. We also tried raising chickens in the hallway, but they smelled even worse. We couldn't let the dogs out to roam because they might be hit by the cars that drove even faster than they had in Culiacan. We were used to having the dogs run free on the farm and basically taking care of themselves. We didn't know anything about walking with them or caring for them properly in an urban environment. To be honest, we were a little lazy about it. And the city kids in our neighborhood didn't play with dogs. Most of the dogs that we came across were running loose, scavenging for garbage. I noticed that those city dogs weren't as skinny as the dogs at the ranch. There was much more food available to them. Plenty of garbage.